To our great shame and humiliation, the American government shut down barrels through day 37 with no end in sight, coming on the heels of the big blue wave that happened in the number of states in the Democratic areas on Tuesday. And now everybody's already looking forward to, first of all, how is all of this blue wave going to affect the shutdown? Is it going to make it more likely to be over? Is it going to push it back further? And then with the other eye, everybody's looking to the 2026 midterm. This election that we just had here was kind of like the tick point to say, all right, now that was the end of the previous election cycle. Now it's on to the next one. And what's that going to do? And so the race has begun. We're going to try to peel back what all this means. And we're very pleased to have today Jim Webb, a defense and policy consultant, somebody who's got a lot of experience working for campaigns and really is kind of plugged into what's going on in the electoral world and can kind of help us peel back between a lot of statements people make and what's actually going on the ground, which is where we like to live. Jim, as always, welcome to the show.
Hey, Dan, great to see you again. Happy to be here. And this is a pretty complicated subject. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm just going to give my best take on it and try and access it with some data.
I'm sorry. I thought you were a soothsayer. I thought that's dumb. So now I don't know what we're going to do. I was expecting perfection and you're seeing into the future, but I guess we'll take whatever we can get.
1800 Wednesday, it'll be
it's
over.
So easy to soothsay in American politics. I mean, who could possibly have missed something coming up? Right. So listen, let's jump right into it. As I said at the beginning of this, the U.S. government shutdown continues to cause pain for everybody, except the politicians who seem to be thinking that it's okay for everybody else to have suffering. And that's part of our problem, I think. But as we're going to discuss, I think there is some pain going on or could be going on for them too. But first, we're going to talk about the pain that is going on. Trump administration announced that they will reduce traffic at 40 airports across the U.S. starting tomorrow if the shutdown continues. The transportation secretary said, hey, look, and we got to do what we got to do because, you know, our TSA folks are having to work without pay. A lot of them are calling in sick. A lot of them are unable to do it. They're a crazy thing about that. I don't know if you knew this, but a lot of them, it turns out they like to eat. And when not getting paid for anything and not being able to pay their car payment, their house payment, or whatever, energy bills, et cetera, it's starting to be a real problem on them. But now that it's starting to cause a problem beyond just the government workers, now then they're actually going to have to cut down. As far as you know, has anything like this ever happened in previous shutdowns where we actually had to curtail traffic at airports?
Not that I've been able to pull up, Dan. This has gotten really, really out of hand and really fast. When you start talking about shutting down airports, you know, it's not just air travel. It is a major economic artery in this country. You know, it's how your mail gets across the country. It's how, you know, it's how people take vacations. Obviously, it's how business operates. I travel a ton. I'm always in airports. It's already kind of a pain due to the old infrastructure to try to get around. But I can't imagine what this is going to do going right into the Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, just in any ordinary time, it's going to be a real problem for the very reason you just mentioned. But, you know, we got this vector coming up, which before, let's say as of Monday, I'm not the expert that you are. I kind of expected that a lot of the elections would kind of be a toss up. We knew some big one, like Mendonca, because he had too big of an lead. But I figured it'd be some pros and cons and it would be an issue, but then they'd kind of move past it. But because of what happens, I think it's actually made it less likely that we're going to get to an end. Because I thought that the vector coming up with Thanksgiving and the air traffic and the TSA and the government's the people that are not working, I thought that that was going to push everybody to finally say, okay, we'll get something off the table. How do you see it now?
Well, I tend to agree with you, Dan. I don't see, particularly coming out of the elections this week, that there's really any impetus for the Democrats to give an inch. And the best way to kind of accent this is really get into the data. What is causing this, right? It's basically a $30 billion subsidy. And that is no small chunk of change.
In fact, before you get into that, if you could kind of boil it down to our viewers, if you can, because it seems to me that at least from the Democrat, that this all comes down to the ACA subsidies.
Correct.
Because the Democrats say, we want that negotiated before we will agree to sign on to an extension of the government. And then the Democrat and the Republican governments are saying, yeah, don't even worry about that. Just give me a clean CR. Is it really that simple?
I would like to think it is, but it's not. If you recall about a decade ago, or really 2017, there was a large push to get the ACA to effectively collapse under its own weight. And that appears to be kind of the, like, it's not stated, but it appears to be the angle which Republicans are doing it or going after right now. The ironic thing is, with this subsidy, and once again, $30 billion wouldn't make a dent in the DOD budget or DOW budget, however you want to say it now. But that subsidy goes to basically what you can amount as Trump's voters. And I personally, I don't like the ACA. I didn't want it to pass when it did. But the reality is it's out there now and you got to deal with it. And a lot of people depend on it. And you're talking 40 to 50 million people who are, you know, they receive this subsidy. And who are these people? They're typically small business owners. They're typical entrepreneurs. They are, you know, they're people who are upper, lower income or middle income, who really rely on this to keep their healthcare costs down because they either work for themselves or they work for a small business that doesn't provide them with healthcare. And if you take a look at how these folks voted in the last election cycle, you're talking 57% of them voted for Trump. Only 32% voted for Harris. They are 47% Republican. Oh, wow. They're 30% independent. 30% independent. It's that middle that everybody fights for in every election cycle. And they're the ones who are going to have to bear the brunt of this in a few months. Because if they don't pass these subsidies, your average premium, according to Kaiser, is going to go from about $890 to over $1,900.
Per month.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're talking about an income bracket that's making, you know, 60K at most, 40, it's about 45 to 60K. That's a ton of money.
Wow. Yeah. It's a huge percentage of your income.
Yeah. And demographically, these are the people who put Trump in office. And, you know, what's kind of interesting about the blue wave, and you can talk about the rhetorical approach to it last time, when we get to it, pardon me. But the interesting thing is this is like a little bit of political judo, which the Democrats have seemed to have like run. They have effectively captured these people, and they're used as pawns by both sides. I can be very clear. I don't think that's right to any stretch. But now they're defending them. Now they're in a position where they are defending the same people who put Trump in office over a $30 billion subsidy to which – there's no real clear explanation from the administration as to why they want to get rid of it. Like, what's your impetus here? Is it strictly cost savings? You can find $30 billion in a lot of places. And this is spiraled out of control. I live in a dark red district in Florida outside of Hurlburt Field. Used to be Matt Gaetz's district. And we have food banks set up throughout my neighborhood. You know, wow. Trailers where those of us who don't rely on a check from the government because we're not GS or military anymore or dropping stuff off for people. And this has real long-term implications because, you know, I don't think it's my opinion, just my opinion or my opinion anymore. That it really sends a message that the quote unquote leadership in this country, and that would be the administration. They are in charge. They have both houses and the executive branch. They also have a Supreme Court that's on their side. You know, they are the people to which the buck stops, you know, and they're not doing what they need to do to take care of the American people, generally speaking, and sure as heck aren't taking care of the voters who put them in office.
And let's get into a little bit of that as best you can ascertain. What is the motivation? We're going to look at both sides of this, but what is the motivation for the Republican side to continue on with this shutdown? Because it's pretty evident that this was an intentional situation. They knew exactly what would happen. Right. They knew what the Democrats were going to say on this because they've been talking about it for quite a long time. And the way they have responded over the now 37 days is like, yeah, not my problem. It's all your fault, and we're not going to do anything. And Mike Johnson, for example, keeps saying over and over how, you know, there's nothing to negotiate. We just want the clean CR, as though that's the only path to getting the shutdown done. And since the Democrats won't do it and five come across the aisle, then they won't do it. what is the, it's, again, as best you can ascertain, what is the motivation for the Republican Party? What do they want to get out of this?
That's a great question, Dan, because I think this is pretty nonsensical across the board. I'm a limited government guy. I would prefer if the federal government, you know, was strictly adherent to the Constitution. We had a Navy and basically no standing army, and all we did was protect commerce and stay the heck out of everybody's life. That'd be a dream to me. However, we have the largest government in the history of man right now. And the way that you want, or the way you may want to reduce it, but the way to actually cut it down to size is to use the system to do it. You have to legislate your way through this. You have to cut the agencies. You have to show leadership and say, hey, here is my objective. Here is what I want to see happen. Go get it. This seems to me at best a very passive aggressive way to get what they want, which is ultimately when you look at, like, say, Doge, for example. You know, they wanted to cut the size of federal government. They did some bits and pieces with Doge. Well, what are they doing now with the government shut down? They're reducing spending. They're riffing people. They're cutting them from the team, so to speak. But it's not a very above board methodology of doing it. And it's once again, lacks leadership. And I think that's their angle. I think they're trying to get the things that they wanted to get done through Doge, but don't have the cojones, if you will, on the legislative side, in the House and the Senate, to actually put up there, because it would anger their constituents and risk their seats.
Yeah, but see, I've heard that, and some have speculated that. How right. do you get there? I mean, number one, Doge was in place. They had it. They could have done a lot more. They stopped moving it. So how does the shutdown help them get to what it done before? And by the way, we're 37 days in, and only a couple of little riffs have been done, and nothing since. So even with that, I don't see what the plan is.
Yeah, and flatly, like, once again, not a soothsayer. I don't see a coherent plan, and this follows a line, you know, throughout the entire administration so far. It's been, you know, it feels like it's been a decade since
Trump. Hasn't even been a year yet, right?
Yeah. With all the different bits and pieces and the chaos and the moving parts, and, you know, every day you wake up and you're about to kick off a war with a new country, you know, and it's hard to track. But the one common theme is there doesn't seem to be a plan, and there doesn't seem to be any real leadership in place to, you know, to move the ball towards a common objective or an objective that they've laid out to begin with. And to go back to the riffs, you know, it may be their plan to use, you know, to use this shutdown to riff people out. But at the same time, you know, the personnel side of the federal government is not the biggest expenditure. You know, and if you're going to target different agencies, there's plenty of fat that can be cut. But once again, you have to have, you know, people with their eye on the ball saying, okay, right. you know, this bulk of administrators over in agency Y, like, we don't need that. What the shutdown has done is it's impacted, you know, agencies that that need to function, that need professionals. And quite frankly, what you're doing and what has been going on, I've watched from my position, is a lot of talent is just leaving. It's not the people you want to have go. It's people right. who have I've dedicated.
Observed that.
Yeah. It's people who have dedicated their career to, you know, advancing the lethality of the military, for one. It's people who have dedicated their careers in law enforcement, you know, different
medical different research. You're going to add that one in there too.
Yeah. You know, they can make a lot of money on the outside, but they've chosen to stay in as actually a public service. And, you know, those are the ones that are, they're now going to leave. And the people who you don't want to have there, the people who just, you know, who are your stereotypical type of, you know, I hate to say like lazy GS, they do exist. You know, they're the ones who are going to cling on and hang on for the long term, and you're going to accomplish nothing except weakened, you know, your own system.
Yeah, I mean, I literally have see it playing out that way. Being in town here, I've got access to a lot of folks like that. Let's move on to what President Trump may be saying, because in the aftermath of both the blue wave and now the starting to be negative reaction on the government shutdown, especially among some of his core supporters, as you mentioned at the outset here, he has a rather unique recommended solution, shall we say.
It's time for Republicans to do what they have to do, and that's terminate the filibuster. It's the only way you can do it. And if you don't terminate the filibuster, you'll be in bad shape. We won't pass any legislation. There'll be no legislation passed for 3 1/4. We have 3 1/4 years, so that's a long time. But when they can't do an extension, and John, I think they've done an extension every single time they've ever been asked for ever. This is the first time they haven't done an extension. Extensions are supposed to be easy, but if they won't do an extension, they won't do any bill, even a simple bill. And we should do our own bills. We should get out. We should do our own bills. We should open up. We should start tonight with the country's open. Congratulations. Then we should pass voter ID. We should pass no mail-in voting. We should pass all the things that we want to pass, make our elections secure and safe, because California is a disaster.
All right, let's take a few of those things in order there. First of all, he said, listen, the only way to get this done is to what some call the nuclear option, which is to get rid of the filibuster. For those who may not know, what is the significance of that, and why haven't the Republican House, Senate done that yet?
So the filibuster keeps the Senate from turning into the House. You have a 60-vote you have a 60-vote threshold, which requires people to work together to come up with, you know, a plan everybody is on board with. You know, and that's the function of the Senate, is to slow everything down. You can write whatever you want on the House side as a congressman, and it'll go to the floor. Odds are it'll get passed, probably on a party line vote these days, but it'll never see the light of day in the Senate, because people understand there's not consensus for it. And that's not how our country was designed. Our country was not designed to just pass laws willy-nilly. Before I go on, I would just like to thank President Harris up there for proposing to eliminate the filibuster, because this was a major, major campaign issue going into the last election cycle. If you go back to some of the rhetoric that was going around on that, myself included, I was freaked out by potentially President Harris getting into office and eliminating all barriers to, you know, that kind of agenda setting. Like you would literally have a one party government at that point. Whoever's in charge could get whatever they wanted done. Trump definitely registered on that. He was very adamant that this was a horrible idea, and they beat a lot of pavement on that issue. And it's really surprising to see him, you know, out there right now, you know, taking, you know, candidate Harris's line on this.
So it looks like he's just saying, hey, I just want a near-term win right now. We'll figure out the rest of it later. Yeah, so I don't have to, because it looks to me like, tell me if you disagree, it looks like he's saying, I don't want to compromise with anybody on anything. Mm-hmm. I just want this to go through. So at least for the next 12 months until a new House gets elected, where he may lose it, but he wants to just back have a clean sweep. How do you see it?
I think you're spot on, but it's very short-sighted, you know, and this is a very common theme with this president, unfortunately. You know, he's very focused on the deal. He wants a deal. He wants something done now. If you look at his, and then you're very familiar with this, I know, with the deal with Russia. He just wants a deal with Russia. And he's willing to do whatever it takes in the immediate term to get that deal. He's not thinking strategically long term, you know, for the betterment of the country. And he eventually is going to not be president at some point. And the other side is going to take over. And if you get rid of the filibuster, you know, the ability for the opposing party in the minority to slow down and destroy legislation, if need be, then you effectively have, you know, it's a rubber stamp. It's no different than executive orders going back and forth. You'll have one party come in, you know, for 4 years, do a whole bunch of stuff that will take the country off in a real wild trajectory. And then the next administration will come in and do the opposite. And it will just create absolute chaos within not only our system of government, but our system of laws. And we can't have that.
That's a great point. So that's something that we should avoid very much, but that's what he wants. But that's not all Trump wants, because he's also saying, hey, you know what would be cool? How's about we get Texas to give me 5 seats, because I deserve them. We're entitled to them. And so here's several other states that I got. So he's like, yeah. And apparently Governor Abbott is like, 2 thumbs up, we're going to give you that. Well, what a surprise. Turns out that California and other Democratic states are not excited about that. That was one of the other part of the blue wave yesterday with this Prop 50, where now Governor Newsom has the capacity to do that. And here's how he put how they're doing it and why they're doing it now.
He doesn't play by a different set of rules. He doesn't believe in the rules. And as a consequence, we need to disabuse ourselves of the way things have been done. It's not good enough to just hold hands, have a candlelight vigil, and talk about the way the world should be. We have got to recognize the cards that have been dealt. And we have got to meet fire with fire. And we've got to be held to a higher level of accountability. So that's what this is about. It's not complicated. We're doing this in reaction to a president of the United States that called a sitting governor of the state of Texas and said, find me five seats. We're doing it in reaction to that act. We're doing it mindful of our higher angels and better angels. We're doing it mindful that we want to model better behavior as we've been doing for 15 years in the state of California with our independent redistricting commission. But we cannot unilaterally disarm. We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear. We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear district by district all across this country, not just in Texas, but in Missouri, where J.D. Vance went just a week ago, in Indiana, in places like Ohio, in places like Florida. We need to stand up.
Now, I'll tell you, I am categorically against what Texas is doing, because in my view, this disenfranchises people who live in those five districts and saying, if you're a Democrat, you don't need to go to the polls because your vote won't count anyway. Mm-hmm. But I am even more against this one, because, and this is what I like your view on, because to me, fighting fire with fire is the wrong. We need to fight fire with a fire hose to put the fire out. Mm-hmm. The last thing we need to do is have more fire, because then more things are going to get consumed in there. And I worry that now then California is looking to disenfranchise all the Republicans that may live in the districts that they're going to redraw, and they're saying that their votes don't count. Now, I'm going to get to the Republican reaction to this in just a second, mm-hmm. but let's look at those two things here. How do you see the issue of both in Texas and California and what Newsom's doing in response?
So I'll start off with, I lived in a extremely gerrymandered district in Maryland. I lived for about a decade in Baltimore, and they drew our district in a way that made voting completely pointless. And it does two things. It creates apathy. It creates multiple things. Apathy, dysfunction, because you never have, you know, a marketplace of opportunity, if you will. There are no competing ideas. There is only one person in charge. And when you're talking about, you know, what they're going to do in California and Texas by disenfranchising large amounts of voters, like, okay, like, you'll have the people who are able to vote with their feet will vote with their feet. That's still the wrong answer, but the large amount of people cannot do that. And if you're telling them that they have no voice and no ability to participate in the democratic process, which, mind you, is designed to prevent violence, particularly political violence, you know, then what happens next? It's a real dangerous slope to go down. One thing I will pull out of what he said before we get back into this is, I really don't understand what he was saying about Missouri. I ran a U.S. Senate campaign there, and man, that state's blood red. Except outside of St. Louis, you could not gerrymander it to be any more Republican than it actually is. But that's kind of besides the point. But no, this is the president calling down and asking for five more votes out of Texas is categorically wrong. You know, and what Newsom is doing is highly opportunistic. I truly don't understand how that man gets elected in California. He's like literally a shapeshifter. You know, you put him in front of different audiences, he's a different guy. He has a hard time with the truth. He comes off as slick and greasy. But at the same time, what Trump is doing, and what always happens in these kinds of scenarios, is he is empowering Newsom to have a logical sounding voice.
Yeah.
And that does not need to happen, because, you know, if the one thing that was propping the Republican Party up going into the next presidential election cycle was the fact that the Democrats have absolutely no bench at the executive level, or the presidential level, there's no one there. But you're giving this guy a fantastic issue set to get out there and sound, you know, like he is just and fighting for the people. And in a sense, like, you could make an argument that he actually is, because he's countering what is obviously wrong and coming down. But it doesn't make it right.
And let me ask you that, because I had some folks that I have queried and talked to about this say, well, he does kind of have a point, because if they've been trying, this is one of my Democratic friends, they say, because if part of the problem with the Democrats is they've been too weak-kneed and they don't fight, they don't do anything. And so they've been following the rules, and then the rules are going to, Trump is blowing the rules off. So he's got to do this or it's not going to work. Is that true? Is it that the only thing that the Democrats have is to break the rules or rewrite the rules in a different way that disenfranchises somebody? Or is there another path? What else could they do?
Well, I think it's important to point out that, you know, I sort of mentioned this a second ago, but they are giving the Democrats the opportunity to play dirty. Strictly speaking here, you know, it's he is handing Newsom and other governors around the state exactly what they want. You know, when you're talking about, you know, when you get out there and say, hey, gerrymandering is bad, we don't do that, we're against that. President Trump could have said very easily, we want to redistrict, but we're going to do it in a neutral sense. Like, we're just going to draw little squares all across, you know, according to population, and let the chips fall where they may. But by presenting it as, you know, in effect, a favor to him to provide him, you know, extra clout in the House, you know, they are allowing governors across the country on the Democratic side to ensure that their party stays in power indefinitely. You know, you could very well, you know, it's you could change what your platform is if you're the Democrats. You could change your platform, you know, if you're the Republicans, and appeal to more voters. Show some leadership. That would be the way to get votes. Like,
show some leadership.
That's the American way. But it's incentivizing not doing it, and it's really kind of tragic.
I want to, Gary, I'm going to skip the next one we had there about the GOP has predictably filed a lawsuit against this. They say it's unconstitutional, whatever, in California. But apparently it's cool in Texas, so we'll see how that's going to work out there. We'll see how either one of them are going to work out, but that's where they're headed at the moment. I want to kind of come back to both the combination of where the shutdown is right now and how yesterday is affecting the two political parties and where this may be headed in 2026. Here was Mike Johnson, I think it was earlier this morning, talking about the shutdown and saying how it's all the Democrats' fault.
The Democrats have painted themselves into a corner, Joe, as we've discussed before, because this really was, as some people say, the Seinfeld shutdown. It's a shutdown about nothing. There was no fight. There was no skirmish between the parties. When we passed back on September 19th, the Clean Continuing Resolution, it was nonpartisan. You know, it's 24 pages in length, bare bones, just to keep the lights on. And this is an important point. The whole reason for that is because the Republicans and the Democrats, who were appropriators, got together and said, we're running out of time to do the normal process, the regular order of funding the government. We need about 7 more weeks. So let's just extend it to November 21, and we'll all get our work done. That was the agreement they made, bipartisan and bicameral. But then Chuck Schumer decided to throw a big wrench in the middle of the machine, because he wanted to show a fight against President Trump because he needs political cover against the rising radicals in his party. I mean, that's pure and simple what this is about.
Is it pure and simple? That's what it was about from the Democratic side?
Not at all, Dan. I'll go back to I'll give Mike Johnson I'll throw him one little bone at the end of that. He is right about what Schumer was doing. But it ties into the longer-term political judo, which the Dems have been playing. If you look at their messaging in all of these different races, you know, we had, Bidenflation during the last election cycle, during the presidential cycle. The Dems turned that into, the unaffordability crisis. You know, and where they're positioning themselves continuously is kind of trifold. One is, they're on the side of the people and bringing costs down. A key piece of this is the expiring subsidies. Had the Republicans agreed to extend those subsidies, wouldn't have been an issue at all. Would have gone away. Nobody would have cared. Now you walk up into these most recent elections with that in mind. Look at Mondami in New York. He ran a very local campaign, very local. Don't like the guy. I mean, I don't know him personally, so I can't say I don't like him. I don't like his policies. Not a big fan of socialism. Spanberger, same deal. but they are focused on what is impacting their constituents most. That is their pocketbooks. That is the prices that are of everything right now. They have not, inflation has not really slowed down all that much. It keeps going up. I keep waiting to walk into Publix down here and be able to buy steaks at a reasonable price. But looks like I have chicken now, like chicken for days, chicken for months.
Chicken's pretty expensive too, man. At least up here in the giant food store.
Man. But, you know, but also the way that particularly Spamburger did it and the way that Mondami did it is they went directly to the people. I very carefully watched Spamburger's acceptance speech. She was very gracious. I don't think she's a particularly hard-hitting politician. I don't think she's a great candidate. But she represented stability. She represented relatability. And she talked about the things that matter to her voters. Mondami is the same thing. They painted this guy as, you know, he's going to put in Sharia law in New York City. We'll see about that.
Communist. An outright communist, even. Yeah.
A communist Islamist. Like,
even though they don't go together, but they're both bad, so toss the names on there and see what sticks. I think that's what they were.
Yeah. So he's a Marxist following atheist who also wants to incorporate the law of Sharia law on people, which is based out the Quran. I must be too slow to get that one, and also I must forget, like, you know, what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan at the hands of Islamists. But to counter that, to get back to my point here, you know, when he went to a Knicks game, he sat in the rafters. They kept talking about Sharia law. He went to a gay bar, you know, and he's relating with the people. Now, the truth about that guy is he's probably going to end up closer to Obama than anybody else in terms of what his actual politics are. And I would be willing to bet that, you know, he's not really going to match the rhetoric he threw out there. But we'll see. We will really see. Going back to Spamburger, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Virginia. But man, being from there and seeing it flip so hard blue and even at the delegate level, is nothing short of a complete reaction to the absolute chaos. And I hate to put it this way, but the vitriol that's been coming out of the White House in terms of how they categorize anybody who disagrees with them. And if I had one piece of advice for President Trump, it would be to absolutely rethink how he perceives Thomas Massey and Rand Paul. I worked for Rand for a couple of years. I got to work alongside Thomas Massey. They are decent people, and they are hardcore America first. Like, in the sense that they were doing it, they were practically applying, you know, those fundamental tenets of being, you know, for Americans before anything else, way before Trump probably even knew what that was. But, you know, I don't get to speak to the president, so.
Yeah.